Welcome, and I would like to thank you all for holding and inform you that your lines are in a listen-only during today's conference until the question-and-answer session. At that time, to ask a question, you'll press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's call is being recorded. If we have any objections, you may disconnect. Now I'd like to turn over to Karen Geary. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hello. My name is Sam Weber, and I'm a program director here at the National Science Foundation. I would like to welcome everybody here to the eighth in our series of lectures about trustworthy computing, and we apparently have quite a few people online as well as in the room. Now, I'm really pleased to introduce Vitaly Shmatikov, our speaker, who is an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin. And when I asked him what I should say to introduce him, he said that he was really very embarrassed about all introductions, and therefore I should keep it short. Therefore, I'll just say that Vitaly has worked in an impressive number of areas in computer security, ranging from analysis of protocols using formal methods to inspecting programs, finding security flaws in web applications, and, of course, privacy, which we'll talk about today.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, and thanks for inviting me. So, yeah, my topic today is going to be anonymity and privacy, especially anonymity and privacy in the era of big data. As I'm sure you all know, we live in a world where information is collected on a massive scale. So no matter what you do, every click you make online, anything you buy, it goes into some big database or databases somewhere. So pretty much all companies today that sell anything or do anything collect information about their customers and information about people's tastes, purchases, things like browsing history, web searches, even medical and genetic data are being collected and analyzed on a massive scale. These companies are all so-called social networking companies, except one very prominent exception in the middle. They don't seem to make any money. But to the extent they make money, they promise to make it by telling their investors that they will monetize and make money by analyzing people's data and data about social relationships. These companies are a little less known. They operate kind of behind the scenes, and they specialize in collecting information about people's browsing behavior. Pretty much any click you make anywhere is captured by one of these companies, sometimes by multiple companies, and put together and used to target advertising and monetize in various other ways. And another trend that we're seeing is that there is a tremendous amount of aggregation of information going on, both online and offline. So information collected about people's online behavior and transactions that they make online is actually being correlated and connected with offline databases, things like financial records, credit reports, stuff like this, and social relationships as well. And the objective here is to create these massive databases that capture kind of your entire life history. So, and of course, this massive data collection going on raises an important question. What about privacy of all of this? So clearly people understand that a lot of this information is very sensitive. It could be used for various nefarious ends or just annoying ends, like spam and advertising that you don't want to see and stuff like this could also be useful. So what do they do to protect your privacy when they actually share this information with each other and sell it and so on? So that seems like a most excellent question. And if you look at what people actually do and the existing privacy protection methods, for the most part, they focus on this notion of personally identifiable information. So the way privacy protection works today, for all intents and purposes, is that they take this data set that they collected about people and anonymize them by removing so-called personally identifiable information. And that's a magic transformation that they do. And once they remove this personally identifiable information, data becomes safe because now there is it's not linked to specific individuals that could be shared or sold or published. You can do whatever you want with it. And this notion of personally identifiable information, sometimes called personally identifying information, or just shortly PII, we see it all over the place. So no matter where we look, and no matter whoever asks questions about protecting privacy, the answer is always the same. There is nothing to worry about here because by the time we give this data to anyone, personal identifiable information is gone. So, for example, this is the previous chief privacy officer of Facebook testifying before Congress and drawing the distinction, critical distinction, between the use of information in personal identifiable form and the sharing of information in non-personal identifiable form. So you can see sort of here a built-in assumption that information exists in two forms. There is a personal identifiable form and the non-personal identifiable form. And once you converted it from one form to another, it becomes safe to share, safe to use, in many cases even safe to publish. And you see this distinction all over the place. Like, for example, these are companies that specialize in social networking, and they sell what they call social engagement data, consists of anonymous information regarding relationships between people. What does it mean, anonymous? Personal identifiable information has been removed. If you do a Google search for "we do not collect personal identifiable information," 30 million answers come up. So clearly this concept is all over the place. So you can even get a certain seal of approval for behavioral advertising. They tell you, you know, nothing to worry about because this advertising technology doesn't use PII to deliver relevant advertisements. So, clearly this notion of PII is so important that even the federal government provides some advice on protecting confidentiality of personal identifiable information. So this is all good and very comforting for us as consumers and users of the Internet and so on, but it seems like an important question to ask here. What exactly is this personal identifiable information that they speak of? Okay, because it seems like if privacy protection relies in such a fundamental way on removing personal identifiable information, what is this personal identifiable information? So that's a good question. And this is what I call the myth of de-identification. It's this assumption that I already mentioned, that data exists in two forms, in personal identifiable and non-personal identifiable, and there is a transformation that you can make to convert personal identifiable into non-personal identifiable. The analogy that I usually draw is with medieval alchemists, okay? So they believe that you could take lead and by applying something to it, you can turn it into gold. So in the same way, you can take identifiable information and turn it into safe, good, non-personal identifiable information. How? Well, some things are fairly obvious. You remove things like names, email addresses, and so on. So it's been understood for quite some time that this is not enough. There could be remaining information there, so-called quasi-identifiers, that could still be used to identify people, even if explicit identifiers like email addresses and phone numbers and social security numbers have been removed. And this notion of quasi-identifier underlies many privacy protection technologies existing today. For example, K-anonymity and various flavors of K-anonymity that require you that every combination of quasi-identifiers has to occur a certain number of times. But again, this sort of pushes the question into a different direction, but what is a quasi-identifier? What exactly is the information that could be used to identify individuals? And that's an important question because it has been shown that things like demographic information, zip codes, genders, especially in combination, could be used to identify people. But is it the only kind of information that could be used for identification? Are the same attributes identifying or quasi-identifying for every individual, or maybe different things could be used to identify different individuals? So these are important questions that seem very fundamental here, because if your privacy protection relies on removing identifiers or doing something with quasi-identifiers, what are they? And we've known, actually, for quite some time that this notion of protecting information and de-identifying it using specific identifiers is not sufficient. So Exhibit A here is the AOL search data scandal, which you might remember. It was 7 or so years ago when AOL released a data set of completely anonymized web searches. It was completely anonymized, no IP addresses, nothing that would be considered an identifier, nothing that would be considered a quasi-identifier, just raw contents of searches. And sure enough, some enterprising newspaper reporter, just by looking at the contents of the searches, figured out that he can identify certain people there. Like there was some lady who was looking for businesses in Lilburn, Georgia, and for fairly rare last name and single man over 50 and what to do with the dog that pees on everything. So as it turns out, that information, which is clearly not identifying by any normal definition of identifying information, once you put this little bit of information together, that's actually enough to identify a person. So he just looked at the phone book for Lilburn, Georgia, found some number of last names that matched what the searches were all about, and there was only one lady there who was apparently over 60, and she was recently widowed, and he just called her up, and she said, oh, yeah, it's me, and indeed, I have this dog who urinates on everything, and, you know, if you know some nice older man, let me know. So, and what this tells you is that there is this information in the data itself that can be used to identify people, even in data that's completely anonymized and de-identified and contains nothing that would be considered personally identifiable information, whether according to the federal definition of personal identifying information or whatever definition of personal identifying information this company has used when they de-anonymized the data. And unfortunately, as you look at threats to privacy and various adversarial models, no matter what threat you worry about, and there are lots of things to worry about. You could be worried about abusive marketing or phishing or just nosy employers or acquaintances looking for you, and some people even worry about surveillance and the legitimate collection of data by law enforcement agencies. No matter what scenario you worry about, what they all have in common is something that a lot of existing privacy protection mechanisms try to ignore. And that's the notion that the adversary already has some access to information about what they're looking for. This is known as technically auxiliary knowledge or background knowledge or auxiliary information. And this is information about people that's available to adversary outside of the normal data release process. And this could be available from public databases, water cooler conversations, and so on. Like in the AOL search data, that data was correlated with things like public phone books and stuff like this. So there are always other sources of information out there, and what I'm trying to say is that information that is not personally identifiable by itself can become personally identifiable if the adversary has access to a little bit of information about what they're looking for, so kind of like a little noisy fragment of the record that they're already looking for. So, of course, the first thought that comes to mind when you think about this problem, especially if you're a computer scientist, is access control, okay? So the way to solve privacy problems is by access control, and that makes sense. You know, we're computer scientists. We know from access control. We've been thinking about it for 40 years. So this notion that everybody should own and control their personal data. And that's a good notion, but once you try to think about it, you realize that it's actually very difficult to apply it in a meaningful way to a lot of data that we have to deal with today. Like, for example, in social networks, information about relationships is shared. So I might consider my end of the relationship private. The other end, they might not consider it private. In things like genetic data, it's even worse, because what does it mean to exercise access control over genetic data? Obviously, genetic information is shared with all blood relatives, and huge chunks of a person's genome could be reconstructed with access to genetic information of their relative. And this means that, in some sense, access control is almost meaningful for genetic data because it could be reconstructed from other people's genetic data. In complex systems that I'm going to talk about a little bit more later in the talk, it's even worse because there is such a complicated dependence of the output of computations on the input of computation, it's just impossible to trace all dependencies in order to exercise access control. So it's unlikely that access control alone is going to be the problem. So that is going to be the solution to this problem. But even before we talk about solutions, let's try to understand the problem a little more. And this is something that I've been working on for the past few years with Arvind Narayanan, who is a former student of mine, now a postdoc at Stanford. So we looked at several scenarios in which people release anonymized data and try to figure out, so what could be learned from this so-called anonymized de-identified data? So I'm going to look at three case studies today. One involves anonymized transactional data, and these results are applicable to anything that involves records of individual purchases, expressed preferences, tastes, stuff like this. I'm going to use, and this is typically relational data, so it's kind of in the form of kind of neat records in the database. I'm also going to look at anonymized graph data that comes up in social networking and graphs of human relationships. The final case study is going to be when what is released is aggregate statistics that involve no raw data at all, so just high-level statistics computed from the data. And let's try to see what could be learned from this. So let's start with anonymized transactional data. So in this case, you can think of data as just the database where each row corresponds to a customer record and columns are transactions, preferences, things like this. For example, the infamous Netflix price data set contains movie viewing records of 500,000 individuals. And you can think of each row as a customer and each column as a movie and whether they viewed it or not and whether they liked it or not. If we're talking some online retailer, every column would be an item that they might have bought, and the records would be individual customers. The most important thing about this data set from the privacy privacy point of view is that they're highly multidimensional. So if we think of every item that could be bought or every item about which a preference could be expressed, like in the case of movies or Netflix or items available for sale in some online retailer or offline retailer for that matter, there are hundreds of thousands or millions or dozens of millions of them. So if you view each record, each customer record as a point in the space where the coordinates correspond to whether they viewed that movie or not, this space is highly multidimensional. And those of you who work in data analysis know is that typically these multidimensional spaces are characterized by a property known as sparsity, which has tremendous implications for privacy. You might not think this from right away, but I'm going to show you now that this, the fact that they're so multidimensional and so sparse has very important implications. So let me just show you how sparse they are by just picking one point from this graph. And this graph corresponds to the Netflix price data set. So as I mentioned, there's a movie viewing records of 500,000 subscribers of Netflix released 5 years ago to support a data mining competition. So in the Netflix data set, so if you just look at movie names, whether the customer watched it or not, for 90% of the records, there isn't a single other record in the data set, which is more than 30% similar. So what this really tells you is that every record is unique, or the overwhelming majority of records are unique in a very strong sense. Not only are they unique, they are highly dissimilar to anybody else in the database. So if you look at these records, they are really standalone. So each record in this multidimensional space, like it's in, even if you draw a huge neighborhood around this record, there will be nobody even remotely similar to it. And what this means for privacy is that even if you have a little bit of information about the record, even if you can roughly pinpoint the neighborhood of that record, you will find that record because there is nobody even similar to it. So if there is nobody similar to you, even a tiny bit of information about you is enough to identify your record, even if it's been completely de-identified, just based on information contained there. So so this is a paper that we published a few years ago in Auckland Conference on Security and Privacy, where we do analysis, both kind of generic analysis, trying to show under what properties of the data set identification is possible, even if the data set, and I should have mentioned that this Netflix price data set, of course, was completely anonymized. So we do both the generic analysis and we do concrete analysis of the Netflix price data set. So, and generically, we show that under very mild sparsity assumptions, you need a very small amount of information, roughly logarithmic in the size of the data set, to be able to identify a record. So knowing even a little bit about the record, having a little bit of auxiliary information, is enough to find it in the data set. In the concrete case of the Netflix price data set, turns out it's even less. So knowing just four dated ratings of a person is enough to find their record in this huge data set of 500,000 anonymized histories. That's how sparse it is. So knowing just four little points is enough to pinpoint the record. We often get asked is how do we know that the match is correct? So because we don't have an oracle, we actually developed some statistical technology to argue why our identification is correct. That's not important. The point that I want to make, that this question, this idea of asking how do you know that you found the right record, is in many ways the wrong question. So because sometimes, so the question you should be asking is not can you find my record, but what can you learn about me by analyzing the data set? Because in some cases, we cannot quite pinpoint the record. We can only find a cluster of records, a small cluster, and prove that the record belongs to this cluster. So even though we can pinpoint an individual record, they often have something in common. They often have some characteristic in common. And what this tells us is that if I find a bunch of records that all have the same characteristic, and I know that yours is one of them, that's enough for me to figure out that you have the same characteristics. So identifying a cluster sometimes is as good as identifying an individual record, because I learned whatever I wanted to learn by finding the group to which you belong, as opposed to finding an individual record. So in this case, we're dealing with very nicely organized transactional data laid out in a relational database where records are very sparse. So kind of fairly basic techniques for identification work. But in social networks, we have to deal with anonymized graph data, which is more complex because it's not relational anymore. And by the way, so here is an important point that I always try to make when I talk about this. When I say social networks, people think Facebook and like, well, what exactly is the privacy issue on like Facebook or Twitter? You know, the whole thing is about kind of exhibitionism. So, you know, what are privacy issues? But you have to understand, social networks have been studied for a long time before even computer scientists came onto the scene and before online social networks appeared. Like sociologists studied social networks for many years. So here is an example of a social network taken from a real sociology paper representing, you can see, it's a romantic and sexual network among high schoolers in a particular Midwestern high school. You can see that this data, this is anonymized network, the underlying data is extremely sensitive, like things like the existence of triangles on this graph, all kinds of things, okay? So when I say social network and privacy in social networks, try to think about networks like this. So it's not just about Facebook. It's about sociology data. It's about phone call graphs, which, by the way, are increasingly outsourced for processing because smaller companies, like smaller cell phone companies, they don't have their own data mining expertise in-house, so they have to outsource processing to third parties. So like, think about this as a social network, not just things like Facebook and so on. So in another paper of ours that published a few years ago, also in Auckland, we looked at how easy it is to identify people in completely anonymized social networks. So in this case, our target is not even records, it's a pure graph. So unlike in the case of Netflix, there aren't any attributes, it's just graph, okay? Just nodes and edges, unlabeled. So it seems like that loses all information, like what is there to identify? It turns out that the topological structure of your neighborhood and the social graph, that in itself acts as an identifying factor. That could be used to identify people with great success. And what we exploit for this is the fact that people rarely belong to a single social network. They usually belong to multiple social networks, whether online and offline. So if we have another network, and it could have even a small overlap with the target network, but as long as there is some overlap, it could be used for identifying people in a completely anonymized graph. So effectively, I'm not going to go into details because I don't have time for this, but effectively we take a small number of nodes to start mapping, and then we use existing nodes to build the mapping. So effectively, if we see two nodes, so if we have two nodes already mapped, and then we see two more nodes, and they seem to have a relationship with the already mapped nodes, then we try to construct a mapping, and so on. So I know it sounds a little vague, but the idea is that it's an iterative process by which we use existing mappings to construct more mappings. So effectively, we reconstruct the structure of social relationships in the graph using local social neighborhoods as an identifying factor to help us construct more mappings. So the important part about this process, and this is something that is often overlooked by people who design privacy protection technologies, is that this is an iterative process. That de-identification and de-anonymization is rarely a one-step game. So effectively, you use your auxiliary information to get to identify a few nodes. Then you use those nodes as auxiliary information for the next round of identification. So it kind of snowballs. And you use more information to continue with de-anonymization and so on. And most privacy protection technologies that exist today are based on this idea that the attacker is going to come in and de-anonymize. But in this case, you use that first round as an input to the second round as an input to the third round. So effectively, there is a feedback process that feeds on itself. And this idea of iterative re-identification is extremely powerful. It's been successfully tested on real-world networks such as Flickr and Twitter, and Arvind Narayanan, who is my former student, he continued working on this, showing that you can win data mining competitions using this technology. So it's kind of a gift that keeps on giving. So this idea of iterative re-identification of graph data. Okay, so far so good, but at least in these cases, we're given the raw data, either anonymized transactions or, in this case, completely anonymized graph. Let's look at a different setting where we're given no raw data at all, where we simply don't have access to the underlying data set. Let's suppose all we have is statistics about underlying data. So, and these statistics, I mean, they could be computed in a pretty complex way. So the particular case I'm going to look at here is recommender systems. And I'm sure you've all seen recommender systems. They pretty much every website seems to have them. These are things that suggest other things based on things you like. So they take information from people. Like on Amazon, I'm sure you've seen, like, if you like this book, you might also like those books. So they generate these recommendations. And these recommendations are based on correlations between items. So they take all transactions. They run some complicated data mining algorithm on it, some rocket science data analysis stuff, which computes correlations between items and uses them to produce recommendations. Now, what's very important about this process is in most modern systems, there's a statistical relationship between items, not between people. So people who buy X also buy Y. It's aggregated from thousands or millions of transactions. And notice that there is no user-specific information. At this point, when they publish this recommendation, all user-specific information is gone. These are not related. They don't tell you that there is another user like you in the system. All they tell you is, like, for individual items, they tell you there are other items that are correlated with this item. So this information, not only is statistics, it's not even statistics about users. It's statistics about items. So it seems completely hopeless to be able to infer anything about individual user purchases by looking at this public statistics. So this seems completely safe from the privacy perspective, right? Because all they tell you is that people who bought a particular book, and there could be hundreds of such people, are also likely to buy some other book. But again, this is based on hundreds of transactions, no user-specific information. So clearly safe from the privacy perspective. So last year, we published also in Auckland another paper where we show that even though individual recommendations that you get, like if you just get a snapshot of recommendations over, if you get a snapshot of recommendations, like you might also like lists from a recommender system, by itself they're harmless. But if you track their changes over time, you can figure out what are the individual inputs that resulted in those changes. So let me try to illustrate this with a very simplified example. So suppose we know some items associated with some users. So we know that a user is likely to watch certain TV shows. So somehow we came into possession of this information or maybe gleaned it from their blog or from their Facebook profile or from some other public information. So this is going to be our auxiliary knowledge. So the question is, what else can we learn about this user? And remember, the only thing we have access to is the outputs of recommender system. And by the way, I'm not talking about outputs of the recommender system for this user, okay? I'm talking about global public outputs of recommender system. And what modern recommender systems do is for each item individually, they'll tell us what other items are associated with this item. So they'll tell us, for example, that people who watch House are also likely to work to watch The Office on 30 Rock. Okay? So that's all the system gives us for an individual item. So it doesn't give us user-specific information. For an individual item, it tells us what other items are correlated with it. Yes?
How do you know that they're not actually telling you that, but in fact, they're doing some helping you.
Yes, they are, as a matter of fact, doing some complicated models, right? So, but at the end of the day, it's still based on computing correlations between items based on individual transactions. So there is a complicated model in there. And it actually, it takes a lot of effort to reverse engineer that model and to figure out what they're doing. But the important thing is that at the end of the day, the reason these things appear on the list is because they're correlated with it, okay? By itself, that information is completely harmless because the number of people who watch this is millions, okay? The number of people who watch this is millions. So by itself, this information doesn't tell you anything. But now, suppose we watch this list, and we watch them over a long time. Well, in the case of our experiment, some experiments ran for 2 years, okay? So we keep collecting this information. We keep watching how this related items list evolve over time. And then one fine morning, let's suppose we see the following, that there is a particular item that appears at approximately the same time on all related item lists associated with this person. Or maybe it was on some of them, but it rose in ranking. So what do you think might be the reason for this? That some item would appear on all related items lists. Well, like the technical reason, so the reason an item is on the list is because it's correlated with an item. So if a particular item appears on all of these lists at approximately the same time or rises on all of them at approximately the same time, what does this tell us about its correlation with the items associated with this user? What it tells us is that there is a stronger correlation between this new item and all items associated with this user. So this means that all of these correlations increase at approximately the same time. Now, why might this correlation, like one increase in harmless, but in this case, so this is simplified, we're not looking at 3 items, maybe we're looking at 10 items or 15 items, why would the correlation increase with all 15 items at approximately the same time? Because they purchased that item or they started watching it and so on. So see what's happening here? So not only there is no personal identifiable information, not only there is no raw data, I'm just looking at statistics. And statistics themselves don't tell me anything. But how they change over time actually reveals information. By looking at the dynamics of this statistics, by looking at how they change over time, I can figure out that if they all increase at approximately the same time, the only explanation for this, and of course, you need to do some fairly sophisticated statistical analysis to show this, but at an informal level, the only explanation for this is that something happened. There is some underlying transaction that happened, like the purchase of this item, that caused the correlation of this item to increase with all items previously purchased or viewed or preferred by this user. And you can see the effect of this simultaneous increase in correlation through public recommendations, which are not even based on this user. They're based on global information, but if they all increase at the same time, this means that effectively you see kind of a little ripple, like a butterfly flips its wings, and then you can see the ripple through the data set, and it manifests itself in the subtle changes in the related items list, which you can use to go back and reconstruct, in many cases, the individual input that caused that change. Okay? So what it tells you that So what does this fact that you can infer individual transactions by looking at changes in global statistics, what does it tell you? Well, to my mind, what it tells you is that this notion of personally identifiable information is largely meaningless, okay? That even if not only the data is anonymous, even if the data is gone, if you're just looking at statistics, you can still learn information about individual inputs. So let me summarize a few themes of this part of the talk. So this notion of personal identifiable, if not meaningless, it's really very hard to capture what people mean by this because you can infer information about individual behavior even from completely anonymized transactional data sets, from completely anonymized graphs, even aggregate statistics. Most data sets containing human behavior and human characteristics tend to be very sparse, meaning that even a small amount of auxiliary information is sufficient for re-identification, even in the absence of identifiers or quasi-identifiers. And also that de-identification is an iterative process. It feeds on itself. You can use the output of one stage for subsequent re-identification and so on. So now let me talk a little bit about what has to be done here. Okay? Yes. You could, by introducing noise in the underlying data, effectively splitting and so on. Our experience shows that it's extremely hard for people to keep their personas completely separate. So, for example, in our experiments in cross-correlating social graph data, even a small overlap in relationships, okay, even if you have 50 friends in one network and 50 friends in another network and the common subset is like 3 or 4, even that turns out to be sufficient for identification. That's how sparse it is. So creating completely non-overlapping personas is very hard. Not to mention, we're analyzing raw data, but in practice, even if people like have completely different personas, they tend to reuse the same usernames, you know, so there are lots of factors. So it works, but it's hard to do from a human perspective. And of course, many real humans don't even bother. So now let me talk a little bit about where I see, where I think this field is going or has to be going. Like, what do we actually need to do as a research community, because that's my perspective as a researcher, but also people who work on real-world solutions, what they might be looking at. So the first important concept that people really need to understand is that it's fairly futile to think about privacy as property of the data, okay? You're unlikely to win the game if you try to find the magic transformation that takes personal identifiable data and turns into the non-personal identifiable data. So the focus has to shift into uses of data, computations on data, and we have to start asking questions what it means for a computation to be privacy-preserving. How do we design privacy-preserving computation? Things like this. So not think about data transformation, think about the computation and what it means for computation not to leak information. So the first area that has seen a lot of action lately is algorithms for privacy-preserving computation, but there is still a lot to be done. So there is a very successful algorithmic framework that was developed in the past few years called Differential Privacy by Cynthia Dwork and various collaborators. Seems to be taken, at least academic world, by storm. Lots of paper, lots of techniques. Even people are developing systems now for differential privacy computation. The idea here is to give a robust notion of privacy, not for the data, but for computations on the data. So let me zoom in here. So what it means for a computation to be differentially private is they say that every output is produced with similar probability whether any given input is included or not. So effectively, very informally, you know, without Greek symbols, this notion of privacy says that a computation that doesn't depend too much on any individual's data is privacy preserving. Another way of interpreting it is that the risk for an individual doesn't increase very much if they include their data in the data set. So if you take one record out of the data set, the output of the computation is not perturbed too much. So it turns out to be a very helpful and very powerful mathematical definition. So it's a good framework for designing various algorithms. What I still don't know, well, I do. The answer is no. But if you talk to people what they mean by privacy, what they expect, what they want, this notion doesn't map very cleanly onto people's expectations. Of course, you can say, well, their expectations are just wrong, they're unrealistic, and so on. Maybe, but the fact of the matter is that often what people are looking for when they look for privacy-preserving computations and data protection is not quite captured by this notion. And I'm happy to talk offline why this is not. But, you know, for better or for worse, this is pretty much the only notion of privacy-preserving computation that we have now, and there has been a lot of development of various interesting algorithms. We do still have lots of unsolved, even with differential privacy, which is just a framework for doing things, we do have a lot of unsolved problems. Like recommender systems, this problem, how to give these adaptive recommendations over a long period of time without somebody being able to use the outputs to infer the inputs, that has not been solved, okay? okay? That's still an open problem. Another problem that I'm very interested in is analysis of genetic data and how to analyze this data sets like genome-wide association studies that have huge amount of inputs. Again, straightforward applications of differential privacy result in adding too much noise to the data, so they don't work. Many people are interested, for better or for worse, in non-interactive data release, so finding data representations that could be computed in a differentially private way so that you can publish not the raw data but something based on the raw data that's still useful for lots of computations. That's another, seems like a very fruitful area of research. Another line of research that I'm very interested in is kind of the next step. So after you have algorithms for privacy-preserving computation, how about systems for privacy-preserving computation? And by this, I mean, you know, an algorithm is a mathematical artifact. This is, you know, you write some formulas that work, maybe you build a prototype. But how about actually building systems that allow you computing on sensitive data? And some of it is just implementing this algorithmic framework that I talked about, but some of it goes back to very fundamental systems problems. Like, one problem that I'm very interested in is how to compute on data in a way that's guaranteed to leave no traces of that data on the machine where you're doing the computation. So ideally, you would be able to do it in some kind of cloud computing setting. That would be like Holy Grail. This way I can give my data to some, you know, Amazon EC2, and the result comes back, and I'm sure that there are no little bits and pieces of data lying around. But as far as I can tell, this problem even unsolved on a desktop. So even like how to do computation on a desktop machine and then be sure that no traces of that computation remain except the designated output, that's a systems research problem. That's, as far as I can tell, is unsolved. Many problems in this domain of privacy-preserving computation are not even technological problems. They are policy problems and regulation problems. A lot of existing laws that we have, including very prominent laws like HIPAA that deals, some parts of it deal with protecting of biomedical and clinical data, and, for example, FERPA, which deals with protecting educational records, they have this deeply ingrained notion of PII. I mean, they're based around the concept of PII. Okay, so I've been preaching for a few years that this notion of personally identifiable information is largely meaningless because you can learn information about people even from de-identified data. Suppose it goes away. Suppose somebody actually listens to me and they decide this is no good. These laws and regulations should not be based on the concept of personally identifiable information. So what should they be based on? So how should we write laws that protect consumer data, health data, educational data, and so on? So what do we actually tell data holders, and most importantly, their lawyers, about protecting individual information? So in my somewhat limited experience talking to these people, I kind of get a sense of what they like and what they dislike. What they like is clear rules that HIPAA tried to provide and bright lines, and most importantly, what they really like is waivers of liability. If you do the things A, B, and C, then nobody can sue you, nobody can come after you because you de-anonymize the data according to the best-known guidelines. Never mind that this de-anonymization didn't work. Never mind that that somebody could take this de-identified data set and reconstruct huge chunks and re-identify people. But it's clear, you know, they're not privacy experts. What they want is a waiver of liability. So here in my experience are answers that they do not like, and they do not like it very strongly. So what they don't like is being sent to read papers on differential privacy because those are very clever and great theoretical papers. They use a lot of Greek symbols and sophisticated math and integrals and so on. What these people just want to do, they want to do their jobs. They want to share data to the extent they can, and they don't want to read papers about differential privacy. What they also don't like is answers along the lines of you cannot release or share any of this data. And that might be true in some kind of theoretical or academic sense, it is true that there is no non-interactive data release mechanism that releases untransformed data that's de-identified, that cannot be, and nobody can reconstruct the identity. That's just not going to work, but that's not the answer they want to hear. So what they want is some usable mechanisms for actually releasing and sharing that data and computing of that data certainly for tasks that they want to do. Like these days, I work a fair bit with biomedical researchers. There is a large class of computations they want to do, and saying that you just cannot do it seems like both a disservice to them and a disservice to society. Also, telling them that they cannot do anything without having a privacy expert in the room reviewing everything they do, again, that's kind of a non-starter. So what they need is usable systems that actually provide guarantees even when they're used by people who are not necessarily privacy experts. And it's not like I have an answer to this tension between this like and dislike, but I think it's important to understand for people who try to work on designing and building privacy protection technologies that eventually these things have to be used, and they have users, and these users need things that are simple and still provide meaningful protection. Another aspect that I'm interested in is kind of economics of privacy and economics of markets for personal information. I started looking at this fairly recently, like last year or so, and I was amazed by how little I was actually able to find out about what's actually happening to these data sets containing individual information behind the scenes. The first inclination is just to follow the money trail. Like, you click on the web, this goes into the data set, so what actually happens? Like, who buys this information, how it's monetized, and so on. So that seems like a useful thing to know. And to my amazement, I discovered that I can read papers, for example, about markets for stolen credit card numbers, markets for spam, markets for phishing information, okay? That's why we actually know a lot about this. I've never seen anything about markets for personal information. We literally know more about what cyber criminals do with information they obtain illegitimately than what these various companies do with information they obtain legitimately. And I'm not even saying, I mean, I'm not trying to imply that they do anything nefarious. I mean, they have a business to run, and that's great. But, like, all this information about my clicks, it's collected, it's presumably correlated with offline databases that contain my financial information and driver license number and credit reports and so on. But that information seems to pass through a lot of hands and being marketed to advertisers. And I've never seen this trail reconstructed. Certainly these companies don't tell you what they do. So understanding the markets for this and the economics and the incentives of various players seems very important, because there doesn't seem to be any way of building robust privacy protection mechanisms otherwise without understanding what drives the main players in this market. Economic models are fine. It's great that we can, again, write these big formulas with 30 parameters, but it doesn't really help if you don't know what the values for those parameters are. And this is an area where I feel we need a lot more empirical research, the same kind of research that people have been doing with great success to understand markets for cybercrime. I think we need to understand markets and economics for personal data. So anyway, so just to summarize, so algorithms for privacy-preserving computation, systems for privacy-preserving computation, policies and regulations, and economics of privacy. So I feel like these four very broad areas is where most of that action is going to be in the next few years. And this is all I have to say today. Thanks, and let's open for questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question on the audio portion, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. You'll be prompted by our automated service to state your name to help with pronunciation. Again, that's star 1 to ask a question and star 2 to withdraw your question. And one moment, please.
But we do a lot of questions from the room, right?
Yes.
And you don't have to press star 1.
I do have a question. Just one moment. Comes from Siva Rajagopalan. Your line is open.
Thank you. Here's my
Siva Rajagopalan. Your line is open.
Okay. Thank you. Here's my question. You know, there's been security breaches left, right, and center. Just yesterday, Zappos had a security breach, too. But it's not clear how much people or even software companies are worried about it. So the same way, you know, at the very end, you mentioned that there is a market for private data, and actually we don't even know about it. and there's a lot of exchange people, data miners who collect data and keep sharing data. Procter & Gamble has a huge amount of data about us, and many, many companies do, and they share it with third-party organizations that actually process data for them. And they're making money off the data which belongs technically to the individuals in the repository. Why would people get worried about this? They should be, but I don't see... in other words, my question is, privacy is a very important problem, but do you see it coming to a point when individuals will start suing companies? I know companies are worried about it, but would it happen? And so the research should address policy in that sense, but would it ever come to that?
I think it's a very valid question. It is true that it is not clear how much people are worried about this data and so on. I think we'll start seeing a lot of changes once biomedical information becomes more shared, because people may not worry about the record of their purchases and transactions. But once we have online medical records and electronic medical records, and that information is correlated with other things, I think we'll see people being much more worried. But I think it's a very legitimate question, as some kinds of data seem to be more valuable than others, and understanding people's attitudes towards privacy and what they care about is important.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, we are willing to give up our private data to Stop and Shop just to get a few dollars off every time we buy things. But the interesting question would be, for instance, the medical health data, a number of people are going to hold on to different records, highly correlated records, and then it does become, and then the question of does the individual own the record or all these people own the record collectively becomes a very important issue.
I think, by the way, this notion of ownership is very important here, because it is not clear to me that it's in a legal sense owned by the individual who contributed the data. I would not be, I'm not a lawyer, but I would not be surprised if it's actually owned by people who have the record, which makes things a little worse.
Right. Thank you very much.
At this time, I show no further questions on the audio.
It is true that there is the EU Privacy Directive, which is extremely broad. So, again, I'm not a lawyer. This is almost a legal question. But my impression is that anything that you do with the data is technically in violation of the EU Privacy Directive, strictly construed. It's a difficult question. So, empirically, it does seem that companies in Europe are a little bit more cautious with sharing of data and a little bit more protective of the data, but I've never seen any study that tried to measure this quantifiably. But my sense is that getting something like the EU Privacy Directive adopted in this country, that's just not going to happen. There is just too much money at stake in not doing it their way.
So this is in many ways not a new problem for some papers decades ago, but we're depending on trackers and systems. We've seen also in the computer security area issues about information flow and covert channels. It's really hard to quantify, or it's hard to say you don't have any. So I'm wondering if you see any hope for developing any kind of, and here it seems like you can almost certainly re-identify some records if you're willing to put enough effort into it. Do you see any hope for developing any kind of work factor sort of measure for this sort of thing?
Okay, so I think one big hope here is, unlike in the 70s, we can do empirical research now. We could look at how people actually, hopefully, if we're smart about it, but we can look at actual use cases, how people actually use the data, what kind of computations they could do. And I'm not very hopeful about designing a generic mechanism, but you could do sort of use-specific systems and so on. And for those specific cases, like data mining computations on biomedical data, those kinds of things, then maybe, yes, there is some hope to figuring out what the threat models are and some kind of work factor analysis, although we're pretty far from this. But being, but having actual users and actual data sets, I think, is going to help us in a way they didn't have those in the 70s.
So maybe a domain-specific sort of...
I'm kind of a believer in domain specificity in this case, or at least adapting kind of general purpose solutions to domain specific computations. That's right. And now instead of the phone book, we have the Facebook, which in addition to your name and phone number, has all your friends, your favorite movies, your favorite books, what movie, what you watched last night, where you went to dinner last night. So you're right. It all comes from auxiliary information. But unfortunately, that train, to my mind, has left the station. We have increasing amount of auxiliary information. Once published, it never goes away. And with the rise of social networks, we have the ultimate and auxiliary information. Now, things like Facebook, and I don't know what's going to come after Facebook, but for now, not only have all the sources, they're even aggregated in the same place for your convenient use. Just go look it up. A lot of people. And not to mention that you can always correlate information in Facebook with other sources of information.
And photographs.
You should also talk about how Alejandro's stuff with the photographs, so we didn't put it there.
Right. That's important, yes. So as Paul correctly points out, there was very nice research done by Alessandro Acquisti and Gross, I believe, at CMU, showing that, like, photographs, for example. You didn't put the photograph there. Your buddy put the photograph there. But that's enough, because now you can correlate photograph with lots of information, and actually you can complete the chain. I think they're reconstructing social security numbers from photographs put up by people's friends.
In real time with facial recognition from your iPhone.
That's right. So you could build an iPhone app that... Sure. So... This auxiliary information is like my sense is that any defense based on the assumption that I'm going to enumerate and limit sources of auxiliary information, I think that's just kind of dead.
I was intrigued with your economy of privacy, and I'm sure that the fact that there are companies who browse the web and collect the information. So people do pay for credit rating. Right. So maybe somebody starts saying, okay, I'll pay to find out all the data there is about me out there, and maybe you want to take steps to eliminate some of it. I don't know how, because once it's out there, it's like impossible to eliminate it. But at least if people know, maybe they might be more careful or do something.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, now it's also kind of dispersed, but yeah, could happen. Yeah. Right, and there is Cloud, with K, that's another company like that.
I'd like to get to your point about looking at economics. I'm looking in the New York Times this week, an article about teenagers giving their passwords to each other as ways of trusting each other. Knowing that they trust each other. So we're examining how people value their PII and that's some of the
things. Right. Although it is not clear to me that when people do this, they really fully understand what they're giving out. Okay? So yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah, I found that actually article fascinating. So I read it. It was good.
Yeah, So I have, let me give a short two-part answer. So I think, in general, what we mean by privacy and philosophical privacy is a very important topic, so something I should have mentioned in this talk, but I didn't, unfortunately. Privacy as contextual integrity, Helen Nissenbaum's theory of privacy. This is the one, actually the only convincing attempt that I've seen to try to understand from kind of first principles, both philosophical and legal, what we mean when we say privacy. And she has this very nice theory of contextual integrity that there are certain norms that govern transmission of information, and the same information could be violating these norms in one context and not violating it in another context. And this is really a very solid and substantial examination of privacy. So at least Helen and other people are working on this. As far as divorcing our security from the notion of PII, that is very tricky. That is just hard to do because we have such infrastructure in place, authentication, things like this, or how does the bank know that it's you when you call them? That's so wedded to the notion of equivalent of PII, effectively, that it just there is so much infrastructure already in place. It's hard to see this happening anytime soon.
Maybe it's hard to imagine to redo the whole system without PII.
That's right. It's hard to even imagine what it would look like without PII.
First of all, what do you do to protect your own privacy?
Right.
Of course.
I don't know. Except I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer for you. It's live your life as if everything you do on the internet is going to be public, and that's what else is there to do. I mean, you have to effectively assume that all of that information, if you're willing to live with it being public. And if you're not, then maybe you shouldn't be doing this. I know it's not like a great answer, but I don't have a better one.
Let's move on to the questions. We'll take our speaker.
Thanks for having me.
this time. Now we conclude today's conference. You may disconnect. And thank you for your attendance.